Help me welcome our speaker tonight, Nora A., coming to us from right down the road in Dublin. Nora.
Thank you, Rich. I'm Nora. I'm an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date. It is December 26, 2013. I have a sponsor, and I have the privilege of sponsoring other women in this program. I also have a home group. It is the Burning Desire Bonfire Meeting, which is my seasonal home group. And in the off season, my home group is In All Our Affairs, which is a 10, 11, 12 meeting over in Perkasie. And it's a fantastic meeting. Come check us out sometime. So for me, you know, my story began in a non-alcoholic household. My mom is the adult child of two alcoholic parents, and there are quite a few people in my extended family who drink the way that I do. But as far as my parents go, they were really take it or leave it kind of people. There was never wine with dinner. There wasn't bottles of liquor in the house. I think if anything, they had a wine rack with like 9 bottles of wine that are probably still there from, you know, 30 years ago. My dad, I remember the first time he actually even bought a 6-pack of beer, and I was crying because I thought it meant he was an alcoholic, because I had never seen my dad drink alcohol. And I can tell you, he's the one who drinks the beer and ends up pouring half of it down the sink. But my parents did die. It baffles my mind. I mean, I am related to him, but so as a kid, it wasn't in the house. And my parents told me from a very early age, you know, you have the genetics, you could become an alcoholic, you have to be really careful with alcohol. So it was kind of like this taboo, and I was never really exposed to it. But one of the things that I was exposed to very early on and was just very innate in me was this sense of fear, just this sense of like dis-ease and discomfort anywhere that I went. I was this tall, nerdy, gawky little girl, like high energy, really smart. You know, I would be the kid who would be asking 20 questions in the back of the class, like the really outlandish scenarios, overthinking things, because that's how my mind would always work. And I think from early on, I was looking for ways to kind of just soothe myself, to just calm down, to just feel okay, you know, because more than anything, I wanted to feel okay. Again, like I said, I was just kind of always around the place. I mean, my parents were good parents. I had an Irish Catholic upbringing in private school my whole life. And along with that, a lot of religious education. So I grew up going to church. I grew up learning about the Bible. And to me, it was like social studies. Just like I learned history, just like I learned mathematics. It was like, okay, this is the information. I have to memorize it, regurgitate it for this test. But it wasn't something that really kind of got to the soul level. It wasn't something that really touched me. It was just like, okay, I have to go to church. I have to sit and be quiet for an hour and sweat. You know, it wasn't a special moment to me. It didn't have a significance to me, but I had this idea that there was something to pray to, that I could pray. And I don't think I really understood prayer as a child. I was like, you know, it was like, please, 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 please let mom and dad not find out that I failed this test. Like, please get me out of trouble. You know, it was those foxhole, like, kid prayers. Like, please let the parents take me to Disney World for my birthday. It wasn't, you know, an earnest prayer because I really had no idea how to do that. But I realized pretty quickly that, you know, I was different from my peers, that other people could kind of confidently glide into situations that produced a lot of anxiety for me. I've heard people in the room say it was like everyone else had got this guidebook on how to get through life, and I missed that day in school, that I was trying to make it up as I went along where everyone else seemed totally cool and confident. And I always felt different. I always felt different. I was one who I could try to fit in, but no matter what I did, I couldn't. And so I think I was in maybe 7th grade, and I was at a 4th of July party. Well, before that, a girlfriend of mine, her dad used to make like Kahlua milkshakes when we'd have sleepovers at the house. And then finally, I remember on the 4th of July, I really drank Mike's Hard Lemonade. And it was like that itch I couldn't scratch, and I could finally scratch it. I was like, oh, okay. That feeling of comfort, that feeling of relief, that feeling of just being giggly and light and loose and people laughing at me, feeling like I could just effortlessly fit in. I wasn't worrying about what people were saying, what people were thinking. I was just the life of the party in those moments. And I loved that. You know, and I didn't have a lot of alcohol at my disposal at home. I have struggled with problems other than alcoholism. I have struggled with mental health as well. That's definitely part of my story. And I had found other behaviors that were problematic for me. But I still wanted what the bottle gave me. My sister is older than me, so my sister was able to buy alcohol when she turned 21. And again, she's not one of us. She, at 33, probably still has some of the same bottles in her closet at home from her 21st birthday. She's one who maybe has a drink once a year. But she started buying alcohol for me, which made things much easier for me. I would go to parties, I would go to friends' houses where there was alcohol, but for the most part, I was so anxious and I was so tightly wound, I was always terrified of getting caught. For me, my alcoholism really took off when I went off to college. There was nobody babysitting me, there was no rules, I was on my own, and alcohol was everywhere. So I really started, they talk about the female alcoholic who's gone beyond recall within a matter of years, and that was, for me, it was like the light switch. I took right off. And like I said, having mental health issues, you know, alcohol is a depressant. If you mix alcohol and depression, it just amplifies the effects. I would get really self-destructive when I drank, and I actually ended up trying to kill myself, nearly succeeding, and being institutionalized for some time. And I was convinced there was no way, shape, or form it could have had anything to do with the alcohol. I was meeting with a therapist at one point, and I said to her, I was like, why do I get suicidal when I drink? Like, why do I want to kill myself when I drink? And she said to me, why are you still drinking? You know, I said, I just need to be able to get to that point of feeling okay, because I would always overshoot that point. I would start drinking, you know, and all of a sudden I would black out. And to me, that was the point of drinking. I couldn't fathom drinking just to take the edge off. You know, I wanted to go all the way, you know, out of the park, get the home run, get completely blackout drunk. And I started to have some consequences as well. Destroying other people's property, destroying relationships. You know, people would not want to spend time with me because I was such an emotional liability. They didn't know what I was going to do, what I was going to say. And I was really hurtful. And I used to kind of go on the premise, oh, if I didn't remember, it didn't happen. And I hurt a lot of people with that. You know, I thought I was cute. I thought I was funny. And the truth was, I wasn't. I was causing a lot of harm and I was causing a lot of pain. One of the biggest things for me, however, is the big book talks about the incomprehensible demoralization that comes with this disease, and that happened pretty quickly with me. I started making decisions and choices that I wouldn't have made if I was sober. I started compromising parts of myself because I wanted to drink and I needed to drink, and other people could do that for me. I stopped, you know, a lot of things were taken from me. There are a lot of things that happen to women, to female alcoholics. When you drink, you get into some pretty bad situations. And sometimes that guilt and that shame and remorse that hits you the next morning is so painful and so deep that the only way you can fathom to deal with it is to drink it away. And it became this vicious cycle. I would drink. I would black out. I would wake up and find out what happened the night before. And the pain would be so incredibly great, I had to drink again. During this time, I was in college. I was successful. I was holding down a job. I worked in a kitchen, and anyone who's worked in a kitchen can tell you that a lot of them are pretty heavy on the substances. So, you know, I would get drunk in the cooler before my shift or during my shift at work. I never lost a job due to drinking, but I definitely wasn't a reliable employee. You know, my employers couldn't count on me. I became really distant from my family. They would get those phone calls that I was in the hospital. They would get those phone calls that I needed money, you know. My dad was diagnosed with cancer during my senior year of college, and when I came home to be there for his surgery, I was more convinced or more concerned with trying to get my mom to drink with me than I was actually helping my dad, because that's where my head was at, and that's what I was concerned with at the moment, was drinking. So it really got me into a dark place. I'd been in some really poor relationships because if I'm not healthy, I can't even begin to attract another healthy person, you know. And my self-esteem was so incredibly low. If you showed interest in me, that was great. That was enough. If you had alcohol, that was even better. I would date abusive partners. I would date, you know, people who had spotted past, spotted histories, and it only progressively got worse as I drank. So finally, I was dating someone who was doing harder substances. So I said, okay, this person has the problem, not me. I don't have any issues here. And it was becoming just this dark cloud of existing. It was not, you know, life didn't really have light in it. Like, I was just getting through. I'd pass out. I would come to. I managed to graduate. I mean, to this day, that's the grace of my higher power. That's not my own doing. But I was doing an internship. I'm a clinical dietitian today. And when I was doing my internship, I was working with people who had brain injuries, working with people who had liver disease, you know, people who had life-altering diseases as a result of the same exact substances and things that I was going home and doing. And I really thought I was different. You know, I was incredibly irresponsible. I'd be on the road driving drunk. I never got caught, but, you know, I'd have those mornings where I'd have to wake up and check my car, check the police reports, because I was literally terrified of what I had done. I began to kind of hit this dark bottom where I was continuing to try and kill myself or trying not doing much to prolong my life. It was just a sick, miserable existence where I became isolated from my friends. You know, my college teammates had tried to have an intervention with me at one point. And, you know, I said, oh, you party the same way I do. You know, I get these blinders. You get these blinders on, like going to weddings sober today. People do not drink nearly as much at weddings as I thought they did. Because I always thought everyone else was drinking the way I drank at weddings, and I can assure you that's really not the case. But there was all this pain there. You know, I was with somebody, again, who was struggling with their own disease, and they ended up going to treatment. I said, great, they're getting taken care of. My problem's going to be okay. And it turned out that we broke up because that person was deciding to get help. And I continued to descend into this depression where I would pray that I wouldn't wake up in the morning because I felt so empty inside. I didn't think I had anything to live for. I thought, you know, alcohol was kind of my reward for getting through the day. One of my last holidays before I got sober was the 4th of July, and I'll never forget being alone on my couch and realizing I didn't have a single person that I could call to show up to spend the day with me. All I had was bottles. And it progressively got worse for me. I was initially a binge drinker, and it was becoming more frequent. And in October, my grandmother, who had been an alcoholic, passed away. I remember at this time, I was trying to start controlling my drinking. Meanwhile, I had switched from gin and vodka to wine because I thought wine was classy and refined and elegant. And I pretty soon had to take to keeping a box in my fridge. Pretty elegant of me. And I went to this family, I'm Irish, so an Irish wake, and my uncle's like, just have one shot of Fireball, just one shot. And in my heart, I really believed I could have a single shot of Fireball. And of course, you know, for me, that first drink kicks off the phenomenon of craving. It kicks off that mental obsession, and I was blackout drunk. My parents showed up, you know, at the wake, and my mother was in tears because instead of being able to mourn her mother, she was trying to take care of her 24-year-old daughter. I sat down and apparently told my dad about a lot of the things that had happened to me while I was drinking, things that a father never wants to hear, you know, but I lost the ability to kind of control my words or even realize the repercussions of what I was saying to him. And the next morning, you know, my mom had to drive me home from Jersey back to my house in Pennsylvania. I was at the funeral, and my whole family could just hear me throwing up behind the altar when I was supposed to be doing a reading. And my dad looked me straight in the eye, and my dad is a big 6'2", bulky Irishman, and I don't think I've ever seen him in tears, but he looked at me with tears in his eyes, and he said, you have to stop drinking. You have to promise me you're going to stop drinking. And in that moment, I said, yeah, I'll stop. You know, like I had told him times before when he was, you know, rushed to the hospital to see me because I was, you know, they were trying to resuscitate me. When he, you know, got those phone calls, when he had all those instances, you know, being so afraid of me. But in that moment, I think he finally realized just how bad it was. And I still wasn't ready, and I still wasn't done. I would go on these little sprees of trying to stop and starting again. And, you know, I hit my 25th birthday, and I always used to say, I was like, I don't think I'm going to live past 25. I don't think I'm going to live past 25. And God saw that I didn't, because I got a new life at 25. You know, a month after I turned 25 was December of 2013. And at that point, I was drinking pretty consistently, and I went to a family party with the person I was seeing at the time. And no matter what I drank, I could not get drunk. I went through the whole house. I went through the medicine cabinet. I was desperate. I just wanted to get that feeling, to take that edge off, to feel okay. And I couldn't. And I couldn't. And if you know what that's like, you know, with those shaky hands, you're so desperate to just escape, to just get that feeling of okay again. And you can't. It's torture for an alcoholic. I fought him. I said, we need to go to the liquor store. And he said, it's Christmas. You know, Christmas didn't mean anything to me. But I came to that next morning, and something was different. I took a quiz online. Am I an alcoholic? You know, I'm a clinician. I'm a healthcare professional. I know what substance abuse disorder is. And I still took this little quiz online, and it said, you have a serious problem with alcohol. So, of course, I took another one to confirm. And it still said I had a serious problem with alcohol. So I woke up my partner at the time, and I said, I'm an alcoholic. He said, yeah, I know. The thing is, as slick and clever as I thought I was, everyone else already knew. My family knew. My partner knew. My friends most certainly knew. And I had heard of AA, and I went to my first meeting that Friday, and I showed up, and the meeting had closed. I said, great, this is a sign from God. I don't belong here. I'm not an alcoholic. And I happened to be talking to a friend who's in another fellowship, and she said, no, you need to just find another meeting. That's what that means. You know, and that was like the first taste for me of just how powerful the fellowship of this program is, the fellowship of our 12-step programs, but really and truly what we do for each other. Because even today, you know, at 4 years sober, I can still get some pretty crazy thoughts, and I need a sponsor. I need the women in my life to kind of put my thinking back on track. So I did exactly what she said, and I found another meeting. And I sat down, and because I said I was new, I did put my hand up. They read, you know, and they talked about the young person who was scarcely more than a potential alcoholic. And I got really excited. I said, great, I'm a potential alcoholic. I'm not the real thing. I'm not full-blown. Maybe it's like diabetes and I can reverse this. And that's not the case. Again, my higher power came through for me. And I happened to be sitting next to a woman whose story was just like mine. She started to tell me a little bit about herself. She shared that experience, strength, and hope that we're encouraged to share with another alcoholic one-on-one. And I started to identify myself with what she was saying. And I cried. I said, maybe I do belong here. Maybe I am one of these people. And she said, great, what meeting are you going to tomorrow? So I took some advice. I took a meeting list, and I started going to meetings. And I noticed that all the people who were really happy were talking about sponsorship, were talking about steps. So, well, I guess I should get a sponsor. I guess I should do this whole step thing. And I remember getting up the nerve to finally ask another woman to sponsor me, you know, thinking I was like making this life contract, and she was honored. She was excited. And she saved my life. You know, she sat down with me with our literature, with this program, with this book, and started taking me through the steps. You know, for me to admit I was powerless over alcohol and to look at the unmanageability of my life was humbling. You know, I had no shred of a doubt that I was absolutely powerless over the effects of drinking in my life. There were so many things that had happened to me that I swore never would, and they did. And the other thing she mentioned to me in that moment, too, is the power of the word yet. You know, there are things that haven't happened to us yet. We're still eligible for those things to happen. It doesn't matter how long you've been away from a drink or how long you've been drinking. All those things still can happen today. And I need to keep that in mind. You know, as time goes on and as life gets good, life can never get so good that I'll be immune from those effects of alcohol. When it came to higher power, I struggled. You know, I struggled because I said, okay, there's this punishing, angry God, you know, that I grew up with. Because that's what my mom would always say to me. She said, God's punishing you. It's your evilness. Anytime I'd stub my toe, something would go wrong, I was late. She said, God's punishing you. So I thought of God as this punishing, angry figure. And my sponsor had said to me, you need a higher power, and it can't be you. And she suggested using the rooms as my higher power. And that clicked for me. Because when I came to the rooms, as miserable and lonely as I was at that time, I felt okay. I felt okay after I talked to people. I felt okay after I listened to people in the rooms. You know, I got the guidance and the answers that I was so desperately seeking. And for a split second, for the first time in a long time, when I would be sitting in a meeting or talking to another alcoholic, I would start to feel okay. You know, I start to feel a little bit like myself again. So I went with the higher power as the rooms. And turning my will over, I made a start. I made a very scared little start. And, you know, my truth and my experience has been I've really only been able to really capture step three as time's gone on. As doing like thorough step 11 work, you know, my ability to trust today is far beyond anything I ever fathomed when I walked into these rooms. You know, today I know that, you know, my higher power works in amazing ways. I know that just because I don't get what I want or things don't work as I think they should, sometimes there's something greater at work and it's not in my hands, and that's the best place for it to be. The fourth step absolutely scared me, as it scares most of us, but it was a chance for me to get honest. I had held on to some really deep resentments, and when I put them on paper and when I looked at my part in things, I was humbled. You know, I was humbled to see I wasn't this innocent, sweet little person that I thought I was. I was very manipulative. I was very angry, and I was very afraid. I made a list of fears, and we talked about the truth of how the opposite of everything, the opposite of all my fear, is love, and God is love. My higher power is love. So the only thing that's really that powerful to drive out all my fear is my higher power. You know, I need to trust it. I can use that. I can go to that. I can, you know, when I have those fears, if I bring them to my higher power, I will find relief. You know, I will find answers. In retrospect, you know, it took me some time to really kind of get thorough when it came to sex conduct, but I had, at 18 months sober, I was in a position where I was acting out. You know, I wasn't drinking, but I will say I was not emotionally sober. And I put myself in situations where all of a sudden I looked and I said, how did I get here? Truth was, I had been neglecting nightly inventory. My prayer, I'd been dialing it in. It wasn't really an honest and earnest prayer. I wasn't really doing the deeper work. I was doing the surface work. I was going to meetings, but I really wasn't working with others and taking the suggestions that the program was giving us. And that's where I realized I needed an overhaul in that area. And by sitting down with another woman and working with another sponsor, I got a lot of clarity and light in that area. You know, looking at the behavior and the wreckage of my past and where I still needed to do some further clearing that I might find a greater peace. And I did. You know, the fifth step is powerful when you can speak, you know, language of the heart one-on-one to another person, and you invite God into that room and you become free of all this baggage that you've carried. You know, I talked about how I would drink at my problems. I would drink at the guilt and the shame and the fear. And when I sat down and I really opened myself up to another woman, you know, those things started to be removed. I had one thing on my inventory that I swore I would never tell another person because I said, this is just such a dark and horrible thing. I can't possibly tell anyone this. And at that time, I had been traveling for work, and I was listening to The Big Book Comes Alive on CD, and they were talking about how, I think it was Bob Darrell was talking about how you can't afford to hang on to that thing that you think, you know, God will punish you for, or somebody will judge you for. And I'll never forget, I went to a meeting about 20 minutes away, and the topic happened to be the fifth step, as I was sitting on this very thing. And the one woman actually said in the meeting, you know, if you're holding on to something on your fifth step, you can talk to me about it. She literally said that in the room, and I pulled her aside after, and I said, I have to tell you this thing. And I did. You know, to me, that's how my higher power works. My higher power puts people and words into moments that I get what I need. And, you know, I shared this thing with her. We both cried, and she said to me, I still love you. You know, for someone who really didn't love themselves for so long, you know, to give someone my truth, my deepest, darkest secret, and to just be received with such love is something you can only find in these rooms. It's something you can only find, you know, in such an honest and intimate program like Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 6 and 7, and looking at my character defects, I got that framework from working on 4 and 5. And they're my spiritual barometer today. You know, when those character defects start to crop up, it's pretty spot on that I probably haven't been doing inventory. I may not be checking in with my own sponsor, with other women. I'm probably not praying or meditating regularly like I should be. You know, those things go to the wayside and I start acting out. You know, sometimes even as the day goes on, if I stop and I pause and I just take that little spot check inventory, there are things that are revealed to me that I've been sitting on. And I have that chance at any moment to get honest with another woman and to be free of it. I don't have to carry it. Another great book I was introduced to was Drop the Rock, and to really look at a lot of these things and how I'm still carrying them, and really in all areas of my life. You know, I came into AA because of my alcoholism. I came into AA because of my drinking. But the truth is I've continued to take, you know, the first step as far as it relates to a lot of my character defects, recognizing that I'm completely powerless over a lot of these traits, because at one time in my life, they were survival instincts. They were my instincts gone awry. They were what I needed to do to survive. And as a sober woman today, as a sober woman of grace and dignity, I don't have to act that way, and I don't have to be that person anymore. And when I do the work to remove those things, I find that serenity that I've craved for so long. Steps 8 and 9 and making amends. The truth was, as soon as I saw the amends part, I got really excited because I was so ready to apologize to people, to make things right, for everything to be okay. And my sponsor stopped me, you know, because at that point I had not yet taken the first 6, 7 steps. And she said to me, the steps are in order for a reason. She said, I strongly suggest, the Mickey voice, you know the Mickey voice. She said, I strongly suggest you don't do that. And that's how I knew she was basically telling me, don't do it. I was so eager to make amends to other people without really thinking of what I was setting out to do. You know, the act of amends to another person, you know, I'm cleaning up my side of the street, but I can't go make amends to someone else if I'm going to be putting them at greater harm. You know, I really have to be honest and willing. I really have to be, to the best of my ability, you know, sure that I'm not going to repeat that behavior again. So I really needed a lot of deeper emotional work, you know, looking at the nature of my wrongs, looking at, you know, what was really underneath there, what was underlying there that I really needed to work on. And most importantly, the most important amends that I had to make to anyone was to stay sober to the best of my ability. You know, when I drink, all bets are off. You know, I become this selfish, angry, manipulative person. And for me to just go and apologize to these people and become that person again, you know, my words wouldn't mean anything. My actions had to come in. One of the ways I started to make amends to people was by starting to show up again. You know, for a long time, I'd become this really isolated person. You know, I was very absent. And, you know, I got to be a bridesmaid at my girlfriend's wedding because she could count on me to be there sober. Today, my parents, you know, they used to handle me with kid gloves. I was the last one to get the news. They were always terrified of how I was going to react. I was a liability. Today, I'm the person they call for advice. Today, I'm the first one they tell because they respect my opinion and they know I can give them, you know, a direct, honest, straight answer. And that, to me, that's the program. That's not me. That's that honesty I get in this program. That's when I kind of let these things go and I let God in. One of the most powerful moments I think I had was when I reached out to make an amends to a girl from college. I was in a fraternity and she was my little and I caused a lot of harm. And when I reached out, she didn't want to hear from me. You know, it gave me great humility and it gave me great truth that, you know, whenever I think for a second that my alcoholism and my drinking really didn't hurt anyone, I did. I really did hurt people. And I need to remember that I still have the capability to do that again, should I ever pick up. You know, it's a liability. It's a risk I can't afford. It's a risk I can't take. Step 10 and step 11 and 12, they've been the crux of my sobriety. You know, you do that framework, you clear away the wreckage, and you start to get a new way of living and a new life. And if I'm not up on a nightly inventory, that's the first thing to go for my emotional state. I have another woman in the rooms that I'm accountable to. I send her my inventory almost every night, try to do it every night. And I get that feedback. I get that honesty. I get that accountability because I can't afford to hold on to these things anymore. You know, when I put it out there, when I share it with another person, I'm now accountable for my behavior. And that's where a lot of things get illuminated. If something is really persistent, that I continue to be resentful against one person, there's some work that needs to be done there. If I continue to gossip, okay, what's going on with me that all this gossip is continuing to come up? And someone stressed to me too the importance of really, you know, going to God with these things and asking God to remove them, asking God to come in and to, you know, give me some kind of peace, some action, some direction, some answers with all the things that have come up over the course of my day. For me, step 11 was not that white light experience, but it was that sense of peace that I had sought all along in the bottle. I had a situation at a couple months sober where I was tremendously stressed, and I started praying like it was taught to me. And I was really anxious. I was really in my head and feared up, and all of a sudden, peace came over me. And it was a peace unlike anything I'd ever experienced, but it was a feeling for the first time in my life that things were going to be okay. And that's how my higher power works to me today. That's how I knew, oh my gosh, when I pray, no, I don't go to Disney World. I don't get the big fancy house and cars, but I get peace of mind, and that's worth far more than any of those things. And I continue to utilize that as a regular practice. I mean, before I got up here tonight, I absolutely had to pray and take a moment of silence and meditate because I needed to bring God into the room. Because if I'm just speaking from what's in my head, you know, there's no God in that. I need to bring God in and allow him to be here in my heart. Step 12, being of service to others, continues to be just the crown jewel in this whole process, that I get to help other women today, that I get to help other people, you know, whether they're an alcoholic or not. It keeps me enmeshed in this program. It's hard to fall off the edges if you stay in the center of it. You know, sponsoring other women, I didn't understand until I started sponsoring, but truly it does more for you than you realize. I remember calling my sponsor on her birthday in early sobriety because I wanted to drink and I was scared, and she said to me, you know, thank you. I said, why are you thanking me? I interrupted dinner with your boyfriend. And she said, thank you. You're helping me more than you could possibly ever know. And now that I get to be of service, I see that. You know, I've had periods of in my sobriety where I've dealt with things I never thought I would ever have to deal with. You know, I recently am coming out of a pretty serious health scare, and one of the things that was my saving grace was knowing that I was accountable to work with others. You know, knowing that I could sit down and for that hour or two, I could just be present and be there for another woman. And it was the most incredible gift that my higher power could have ever given me. One of the other big pieces of my sobriety has also been service. I was taught from early on, it wasn't if I got into general service, it was when. And I was voluntold into the position of alternate GSR at my first home group. And pretty soon I moved, and then I became a GSR. And it's about a lot more than just sitting in another meeting. It's about being a representative for the group. It's about being a voice. It's about learning patience and tolerance to another degree that you've never experienced. It's changed my sobriety for the better. It's definitely added an additional element of humility. It's added an additional element of honesty. It's allowed me to see truly the beauty of the program and how it works. Meeting a girl the other week who was visiting from Scotland, and the fact that I could reach out to other people I've met as a result of service to find another person in Scotland is pretty incredible. I had been elected secretary of District 47, and due to some circumstances, I ended up in ADCM and then currently DCM. So I'm presently serving District 47 as the district committee member, and that's an even further degree of humility, of honesty, of accountability. I do have a service sponsor who is essential. You know, we talk about the traditions, we talk about the concepts and the legacies, and really just understanding at a deeper level how AA works. You know, how can we keep this thing sustainable so it's here for the next alcoholic who walks into the rooms? You know, I think about everything that had to happen from Bill to now for this program to be here for me. One of the other things that was going through my mind earlier was tonight when we began the meeting, and in many places around the world when they take out the meeting, we have that moment of silence, or we have that prayer, you know, moment of silence for the still sick and suffering alcoholic inside and outside of the rooms. The night of my grandmother's wake, when I was in a blackout, when I was creating a scene, my mom's cousin approached her. She had 20 some odd years sober at the time, and she said to my mom, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will be praying for Nora to find the rooms. When I say the circumstances in my life lined up for me to find these rooms, you know, not of my own accord, I truly believe that's the hand of my higher power. So I believe the fact is every time we have that moment of silence, even before all of us in this room were even born, there was that moment of silence that maybe someday we would find these rooms. You know, that's the power of this program. I've seen it on an international level. I had the privilege of going to IRIPA, the first IRIPA in Ireland, and seeing people from around the world who spoke a different language but still spoke this language of the heart, coming together, sharing our common experiences, sharing our common pain, you know, our fear, but also our solution, but also our serenity and our peace that we find through this common way of life, through these principles, through these steps. And it was one of the most beautiful experiences of my life. I never thought I would be going to Ireland, much less going to Ireland sober. But that's something that the program has done for me. That's something that, you know, the thought of a drink has been removed, you know, from having health problems, from dealing with, you know, difficult life decisions and moments, dealing with loss, losing one of my best friends in sobriety. You know, I haven't felt the need to pick up a drink because I knew I had this program behind me. I knew I had my phone. I knew I had my needs. You know, I could talk to my higher power. I could talk to other women in this program. And they've carried me. The women of this program, without a doubt, have carried me, as has my higher power, in my darkest moments. You know, the gawky little awkward girl who never felt like she fit in, you know, has a place where she can come. You know, I'm a distance runner as well. Sobriety's definitely given me my health back. And as I travel for races, you know, I run into some amazing people, many of whom are sober as well. And there is just this common bond that we all share. There's this common truth, this common way of life. My higher power has also brought a fantastic man into my life. Dating another alcoholic has its own challenges. You know, it definitely requires a deeper level of honesty and intimacy, but it's that language of the heart. It's something that, you know, when one person talks to another, you know, another alcoholic, there's a truth there. We've actually sat down with the traditions and applied them to our relationship, which is a phenomenal experience in itself. But I've continued to grow. You know, the one thing I was taught when I came in was that it's a continual process. You know, I continue to go through the steps, you know, with a different sponsor. I'm in another fellowship as well that's opened my eyes to even some deeper growth that's there. As far as my higher power goes, there's more truth revealed on a regular basis. And I've been blessed. You know, I think the moment for me that I really knew something was changed was when I called my dad, just to talk. Not because I needed money, not because I was in the hospital, not because a paramedic or cop was calling him, but just calling him to see how he was doing. And he said to me, "You don't need to tell me how good you're doing. I can hear it in your voice." You know, and this was a man who was terrified he was going to lose his daughter on more than one occasion. I have a life today. I have people I love. I have genuine relationships. I have deeper relationships, far deeper than anything I ever had, you know, before I walked into these rooms. And I have that peace of mind that I can access at any moment, you know. It's hard to explain to people who don't understand it, but it's the greatest gift that any of us can ever receive. So please keep coming back. Please keep working towards that gift. You know, your higher power loves you, and I love you too. Thank you, guys.